This episode of Table Talk is sponsored by J-Food-O, dedicated to sharing the best Japan has to offer. Over the next few months, J-Food-O and a selection of London restaurants will create seafood and sake pairings for spectator listeners to help develop your knowledge and enjoyment of the drink. The pairing will focus on the concept of umami, which in Japanese means the essence of deliciousness.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
And today we are delighted to be joined by Beata Heyman. Beata is an interior designer. Based in London, she was born and raised in Sweden and spent 9 years working under Nicky Haslam before launching her own brand under her name in 2013. Since then, she has become one of the hottest names in interior design and last year published her first book, Every Room Should Sing. Beata, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. Beata, as our listeners will know, we always start with the same question, which is, what are your earliest memories of food?
So I grew up on a farm in the countryside in the south of Sweden, and it's hard to kind of pinpoint one single memory, but I think one thing that really influenced the way we ate, and mostly my father was the one cooking most of the time, and how he cooked, it was very based on what was there on the farm and the seasons on the farm. So I always remember getting so excited when the first white asparagus. But what was really exciting was when all the berries started coming out, like the strawberries and raspberries and currants. And I think the thing I was the most excited about was that I could go and just have a snack whenever I wanted to. I feel like there wasn't so many snacks in our household, so it was mostly just that I could go and eat.
Foraging for your own
snacks. Exactly. And yeah, I have a lot of memories like that around, you know, whatever was there. Another thing that we never really had a cooked lunch, it was always dinner in the evening, but for lunch we would always just have open sandwiches. There's this thing called leverpastej, which I still really like, which is basically kind of quite a sweet, mild liver pate. And we would have that on an open sandwich, and then we would, you know, cut the cucumber that was grown in the greenhouse to form little eyes, and the tomato was the nose, and we had this kind of faces, and that I just love that so much. So that's something that I remember.
Who tended to do most of the cooking in your household?
So I think nowadays it's only my father, really. I think my mom's too afraid of failure, she says, and the pressure of cooking and it not turning out right. And he just really loves it. So it was back then, perhaps she did a little more, but generally it was always my dad doing all the meals, and he really loved it. I think it's relatively isolating. There's not really that much else to do. And also restaurants in Sweden are really expensive. You absolutely cannot, and rightly so, but you can't have a sip of wine and then drive. So if you want to drink a bit of wine and have a meal, it kind of has to be at home if you don't live in a city. So I think it's became such a big focus of their lives and what they enjoy doing, particularly my father. So it was a really big sort of, him cooking was a really big thing growing up.
And did you cook with him as a child?
He's very impatient, so I'm not sure. No, I didn't really. And that's possibly also what's put my mom off. He's not that good at sort of teaching you about things. Although now I sort of will ask for recipes and I'll write them down. But my mom did a bit of baking, so I used to bake with her a bit. And I remember I always used to ask her to conduct the whole baking session as if we were on a cooking program. And I was always asking her to kind of do the voiceover and telling the audience what we were doing. So I remember that. And then when I got, as soon as I could really, I actually started baking a bit myself. And it was kind of the thing I used to do after school. And I would go through this cookbook from the 70s, I think it was from my granny's from the 60s or something, with all these lurid pictures of food. And I would just go through it and cook, first it was cookies, and then I started baking a bit more with sort of yeast and stuff like that. It got a little bit more advanced. I just really looked at the images of things I liked, and that was actually something I did a lot of when I was a child, mostly out of boredom, I think, and greed.
And what were mealtimes like in your home?
So we've got three siblings, so there's six of us with my parents, and we would always sit down for a meal together as soon as we were you know, kind of old enough to do that, was just maybe 5 years old or something like that. And normally there will be someone getting really angry and like running upstairs and screaming, and it was all quite but I still remember it, like, you know, very fondly. That was the thing we always did. We always sat down around the table and we always had dinner together, which is something I think is like very important. My children, I got a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old. They eat a little bit too early for us. I don't know, it doesn't really make sense to eat with them at the moment. But yeah, I think, obviously, I guess most people would say that, but sharing meals like that has always been like kind of the one thing that we did as a family together. Mm. Still do.
And what about at school? Did you eat lunch at school in Sweden, or did you take your own packed lunches in? How does it work?
You eat lunch, which I don't remember particularly fondly. There was always two alternatives, and this one day there was either you could have brown beans, which was the worst. Like, it literally made me want to throw up. Like, just taking a bite of these brown, it doesn't sound that bad, but it was really terrible. And then the other option was blood sausage with white cabbage salad that was mixed with lingonberries, which was like even worse. And I got my mother, who's a doctor, she wrote this like special note for me saying that I was allergic to these three things and could I please have something else.
And what did you get?
I don't know, maybe it was just like some sandwich or something. I don't remember that, but I really remember her like sorting it out and like standing up for me.
Do school meals tend to be kind of cooked? People wouldn't take in a packed lunch?
No, or? You don't. It's always cooked. It's always cooked. But I think it got a bit better. I don't know what it's like now because it's so long ago. Like, I think it was okay. It wasn't that bad. Sometimes we would get pancakes. That was quite exciting. There was a peat soup I quite liked. Also, spaghetti bolognese was another favourite. Pretty disgusting, I think, back at it. But at the time, that was my favourite one.
After you left school, you spent a year in Florence?
Yes, exactly.
What was that like as a kind of food experience?
It was amazing, actually. Also, it's, again, because it's so expensive to go out to restaurants in Sweden, we didn't ever really used to do that. And then in Italy, it's much more kind of reasonably priced and so delicious. I lived there with my sister, and yeah, we went out quite a bit and like learned about all this. I think also my father's cooking was quite inspired by like the French cuisine, but also Italian, like especially as time went on. So I kind of knew the cuisine quite well, but that was just amazing. There's so much to discover there, and like the ingredients are so amazing. And yeah, we had somehow decided we were only going to eat dinner and like we weren't going to eat lunch. But then we had this quite elaborate breakfast that we did every day, which was always this like fruit salad with orange, apple and banana. And we always used to do like kind of cardamom that we had, what's it called, like put in a pestle and mortar, and some cinnamon and like a splash of freshly squeezed orange juice. And then we had this like huge bowl of like caffè latte next, and then like some roasted almonds. And now I should think it's a bit weird and like
delicious.
It was really delicious, but then like that was the only thing we were allowed to eat, and then we had like a huge dinner in the evening. I'm not sure. But anyway, I still go to Florence quite a lot, and there's like some of my favorite restaurants in the world are there, and I sort of, some of my like best friends live there, for example. And I love Italian food.
Tell us where you like to eat in Florence.
So many different places, but this one quite famous place called Trattoria Camillo, which is incredible. There's a place called Alla Vecchia Bettola, which is a bit more simple. They do amazing vodka pasta there, which is just called Penne Alla Bettola. There's a lunch restaurant, which is incredible, called Sergio Gozzi, which is just by the San Lorenzo Church, which actually I feel is a bit under the radar. People don't really know about it. There's a place called Sustanza. There's another place called Sabatino.
There's so many. Yeah. I should make a note of all these.
Yeah, the list goes on. I was actually just there now with my whole team. I took them there for last weekend. We were there, so 4 or 5 days ago. And I realized I hadn't focused so much on like important thing to see in terms of like art and architecture. I was like very, very focused on the meal times and the food. But that's like the best thing, I think, about traveling, is just eating and going to, you know, interesting places.
And your work is kind of known for pulling together all kinds of different influences. Do you have the same sort of approach to how you eat and the food that you cook?
I feel like I'm not as good at cooking, I think, and not as kind of, I really enjoy cooking, but I know less about it. I feel like I tend to kind of gravitate towards Italian quite a lot because I feel a bit more comfortable doing that. But then I quite enjoy following a recipe. So it's something like Ottolenghi Simple, which I don't think is very simple. But I'll do stuff like that. And then like I learn, you know, then I feel comfortable doing something. I quite like doing that. But then I need to follow a recipe. And also really like Diana Henry Simple as well, which is maybe a little bit more simple. And which I think also, I like trying new things, but I feel like I need some guidance. Otherwise it just goes a bit wrong. And I also really I like baking a lot, which is something I love doing with my children. So then perhaps, I mean, not exactly adventurous, but I do that a bit too.
Has the way you eat or cook changed since you had your children?
A bit, maybe. I really enjoy, I mean, I can't wait until they're a bit older where I can sort of start preparing like dinners for them and stuff like that. I think it's more fun to cook when you cook for other people. So I will like, you know, with my husband, we probably do, I always like talk about how everything is 50-50. But I think we do cook quite like 50-50, depending on who kind of feels like doing it. But I'm really looking forward to having like two more people to cook more properly for. But I think perhaps we do the breakfast become like a little bit more elaborate, I think, with them. Like they really enjoy it and really, really enjoy it. I think it's, to be totally honest, sometimes I think it's quite hard with like small children to find common ground that is genuinely like enjoyed by everyone. I think sometimes like playing with a 1 and 2 year old, I'm not sure if I actually like after 10 minutes I'm to be honest get a bit bored. But like enjoying food together is such an easy thing to do. And like I sort of, I quite like putting out like a white tablecloth and candles and like making it feel really special and like having like nice glasses that I give to them.
Well, that kind of answers maybe what I was about to ask, which is how important is the kind of the aesthetic to eating tea?
I think, so I really like doing that and just like making, I think I get that a bit from my mother maybe. It's never anything like elaborate with like huge tablescapes. It's pretty simple, like white tablecloth and like a candle or something and maybe a small flower. And it's nice getting out like some nice cutlery and like special plates and stuff like that. I guess I enjoy, and that's probably what I like so much about meals. It's just like making a moment out of something and making the best out of what a moment could be. And I think it's enhanced by making some extra effort, basically. So I do quite like doing that if I can.
Definitely. When you moved to London in your early 20s, what was food like then? What were your kind of first memories of British food?
I feel like it was still not, it's definitely not as good as it was now. And also again, things like, obviously like roast and things like that exist in Sweden, but it's not at all a thing like how it is here. One thing that I really loved about the English is actually, yeah, that idea of a Sunday lunch. Maybe it was just my family who for some reason were like, no one has like proper lunch ever. But I don't know, it was just such a like joyous thing that people did that made like Sunday lunch into such a special moment, which I just hadn't really experienced before. And also in general, just how people entertained at home and had people over. And I feel like there was a lot more fun to be had around mealtimes. And that was, I mean, it of course it exists in Sweden, but it's not quite in that same way. But I mean, also I was a teenager before, I say, so people just to like drink themselves into oblivion and like that was that. So I think I started more kind of appreciating how like a meal can be like such a fun thing and such a fun occasion. And just like, you know, long meals where everyone's like drinks wine and it drags on the whole day. And like that kind of long lunch is one of my like favorite things about England.
And in terms of design, what makes for a good space for cooking or eating or entertaining? What do you want in those spaces?
So when we do kitchens, I would sort of never really go to a kitchen company. So we always design like the kitchen and the joinery and everything ourselves. I think quite a lot about it. So I guess one thing is how it looks, but just practically speaking, I think it's a bit of a kind of golden rule that you should have a bit of a triangle when you're cooking. So you sort of always move in a triangle if you can. So it could be between like an island or a table and the fridge or the cooker and the sink. So there's like some sort of circular movement. But I guess it's just, you have to look at the space you've got because that's not always possible and just think about the journey. And I mean, really basic things like the dishwasher should always be next to the sink and like the tap shouldn't be too far away from the cooker if you want to fill the pot. Or you could do a pot filler, which is becoming more popular these days. But, you know, it's a big thing in America. Everyone has a pot filler that just sits, you know, above the cooker, basically.
Yeah. So
on the backsplash above the cooker, and you can just like fill your pot up, which is very handy.
So convenient.
I think because in America, kitchens are so much bigger, so like they kind of have to do that because it's like, and also they, I guess the pots will be a lot bigger as it's just not possible to like carry them from the sink to the cooker. And then I think also, I think the problem with a lot of this like kind of high street kitchen, it like all becomes quite uniform, which is, so I think, kind of trying to add more personality and more warmth by just mixing things up a little bit more in the kitchen and not, I think it's a problem with like bathrooms and kitchens, it all gets quite formulaic. It's, it's too hard for people to kind of think about how to design joinery and you just go to a kitchen, and it's also obviously a lot cheaper, but it's made it often, it just that's where everyone gathers around, like that's the most important room in the house, so really think about how to make it like sort of really special with a lot of individuality. So I love designing kitchens for that reason.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah.
In terms of restaurants in London, both in terms of kind of the food and the design, what are your favourite places to go to?
It feels like not a very exciting answer, but we live not that far from River Cafe. And I have to say, I mean, as does every single person, love going there and like wandering down the river. It's like 5 minutes from our house. What's so amazing about the design there is that it really hasn't dated and has been there for a while now. And it's quite specific, so I'm quite impressed by it. And also they really, it's quite simple, it's quite distinct, but it's really all about the food. So I think that's quite clever how they've done that. If I had done that, I probably would have just, I don't know, add a lot more personality with the interiors and like sort of quirky details and things and moods and stuff, which is like perhaps not the right thing in a restaurant.
Would you be interested in design? Have you designed a restaurant?
I've designed a restaurant that unfortunately closed down, perhaps because of the design. I designed the first Farm Girl Cafe, which is still open, and then they opened a restaurant in Notting Hill, which is in my book, but it did close down, hopefully not because of the design, though. But I'd like to do more things like that. I'm actually working on a hotel in Paris at the moment, so mostly we do residential design. But when you do, what's so fun, I think, about a restaurant, it's more like an experience for, you know, for a few hours. So I think you can push it a little bit more. But I like how at River Cafe, for example, they were quite restrained about it. Another place I really like, I'm not a member, but the Academy Club. I don't know if you've ever been there. Matthew Bell, actually, who I think sometimes has written for this book.
Andrew Edmonds, the restaurant.
Exactly. Yeah. So my friend Matthew Bell, who has written for The Spectator before, he's a member there. He's taken me there a few times. That's so amazing and such a sort of secret little pocket. I went to another place called Cafe Deco a few nights ago, which I really liked. Quite sort of clean, simple, simple food. And the Wolseley as well. Again, not the most original answer, but I just think the atmosphere there and the room is just so incredible.
And when you're cooking at home, what are your go-to dishes?
Lately, so I feel I've been quite stressed at work lately. And if I'm stressed, I sort of feel a bit less, I just like can't really fit it in to think about anything elaborate to cook. But there's a lot of pasta with tomato sauce, a lot of pasta in general, because it's just so sort of simple. Also quite like, there's a chickpea soup by my friend Amber Guinness, who's just bringing out a cookbook actually, which I actually brought with me to give you. But it's this rosemary and chickpea soup, which is a recipe by her, which is so delicious. I cook that all the time. She has another recipe that I've just started cooking, which is green lentils, balsamic glazed green lentils with ham or like sort of bacon, which is amazing. So I've started cooking that quite a lot. And yeah, quite sort of simple dishes, quite a lot of sort of pulses and stuff like that, if it's not pasta.
And your motto for design is that every room should sing. Would you apply that same motto to your cooking, or do you have a different approach?
Yeah, no, I think so. Like, as I said, like I'm not as good at cooking. But yeah, I think so. Like, if I think, obviously, when you think about how you, if you compose a meal or whatever, if you're having people over, I always think about how it should complement one another and how obviously one ingredient should bring something else out and there shouldn't be too much of one thing and stuff like that. And like something a bit unexpected maybe. So yeah, I try and apply the same method, but yeah.
And you mentioned baking. What sort of things do you bake?
So my big thing is cinnamon buns, which is a very Swedish, Swedish bun.
What's the secret to a good cinnamon bun?
It's all in the, so you work with fresh yeast. So I think it's about getting that right, which is sometimes a bit difficult, but just like judging when to, so you prove it twice. So first when you like make the dough and then you make the buns and then it has to prove again. And if you get that wrong, if you leave it too short or too long, like they don't rise in the correct way. And like the aim is to make them as like large and fluffy as possible. in Sweden, there's actually this special flour for sweet doughs and also special yeast for sweet doughs. So whenever I make cinnamon buns in Sweden, they turn out a lot better, actually. And then also not to be stingy about the filling. And always use cardamom, I would say. Sometimes people do it without, but I would always mix it into the cinnamon bun. Mm. But that's something I make with my daughters a lot, and they love it. And we stick it in the freezer and like take it out for like breakfast on the weekend. And yeah,
you keep the dough in the freezer.
No, you bake them and then you put them and you defrost them and then you put them in the oven.
Lovely.
And they should always be heated up as well. I think it's always worth like just heating them for like 10 minutes and I don't know 100 degrees or something. Mm. It brings out the flavors.
And Beata, what for you is comfort food?
I think, yeah, pasta again, like pasta with tomato sauce. Yeah, again, growing up, we had this in the greenhouse. It's actually the best tomatoes I've had anywhere in the world. It's the tomatoes from my parents' greenhouse. They're so sweet and flavoursome and delicious. And we'd always have that growing up. And it's such an easy go-to thing. And I think if I could only eat one thing for the rest of my life, it would definitely be pasta with tomato sauce. Had it last night. I have it all the time with like a sort of dollop of butter that's melted and like a bit of parmesan, some fresh basil. Like nothing kind of beats it, I think. When I first started cooking, there's this thing again in Sweden called snabb macaroni, which means fast macaronis. My husband thinks they're disgusting, but they're basically takes 3 minutes and they're ready. And then I would just do like a huge bowl and then I would just put like basically half like chunk of like grated mild cheddar on top, lots of ketchup, lots of butter, and then I would put like a lid from a wok pan on top of it, and then you just needed to melt for like 5 minutes and then I ate the whole thing. I'd quite like to do that now, but my husband is just like too grossed out by it, so I'm sort of not, I haven't.
No secret safe with us.
Yeah.
And do you have a sweet tooth?
Yeah, I do, especially for like baked goods. I think if I sort of haven't had it for a while, I crave it less. I do think it's quite addictive. And then if I start eating like chocolate or something like that, sort of I kind of need it more and more. But yeah, I do a bit, but I've got quite good self-restraint. But yes, I can eat quite a lot when I get going.
And Beata, we normally finish with a question about your desert island meal, but perhaps you've already answered it with your tomato pasta. Is there anything else
you'd
have?
I was going to ask, does it mean like the final last meal or is it like the only meal you can eat?
Never quite clarified it, have we, Liv? It's sort of, if you have one meal.
No, we should let people answer it. I think of it as a death row meal, but that always sounds incredibly bleak. So we go with desert island meal instead.
Yeah.
Well, so yeah, okay, your ultimate meal.
My ultimate meal. So I think I would start with, it's called Vendes roe. And it's this special fish that you get in the Bothnian Bay, like up north in Sweden, between Sweden and Norway, basically. Like very, very fine roe. I never like the sort of bigger stuff, but that one's just so delicious. It's such a delicacy of Sweden. And you just have it on like butter fried toast with some creme fraiche and some like chopped chives as a start, like as a small starter. And then maybe some white asparagus from the farm with some butter. And then this is another Swedish dish. As a main course, I would have this. It's kind of like minced veal. It's kind of like a sort of like a hamburger, but it's minced veal. And you have it with mashed potato, like cream sauce and peas and kind of raw lingonberries, which is really, really delicious. And then I would finish off with crostata, which is a dish from Camillus in Florence, which is like a sort of shortbread pie kind of shell, and then a crème anglaise filling, and then it's all filled with wild strawberries inside, and it's so good, and that would be the pudding. And I would probably have, yeah, some white wine, then some Chianti, then maybe some pudding wine to finish off.
So not tomato pasta, actually. Completely.
No, well, I talked too much about that, but if, yeah.
Well, Beata, thank you very much for joining Table Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.